You'll get a mute button someday, buddy.
Oh, and just like that, we start. How completely appropriate. Maybe I should just mute myself. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. It is Tuesday, and on Tuesdays, none of us is as smart as all of us. And that's because we have a guest with us, because it's time to take a deep dive into a single topic.
Topic du jour today is vaccines and the economics, and in a way, the technology of those vaccines as well, right? Because this is a whole new round of kinds of vaccines we're working on here. The UK, you might have seen in the news this morning, started giving its vaccines today. Pfizer and Moderna are waiting for emergency approval over here from the FDA. And so we're going to talk about all that stuff and what it's going to mean and how soon we can get from here to the other side, frankly.
Yeah, the geeky tech about it is really interesting. The part that got us to this, to these vaccines in, you know, absolutely unheard of record speed, this genetic technology called messenger RNA, mRNA, which has been around for years. It is just now being used for vaccines because in some ways, vaccines are not well funded because arguably it's not good business to cure diseases. So we're going to talk about all of this, all of it.
That's a good line. Not good business to cure diseases. Making us smart on the tech and the economics of all this is Safi Bakal. He is a biotech investor, entrepreneur also. He's an author. His book is called Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi, thanks for coming on Make Me Smart.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So these vaccines that we're getting, these mRNA vaccines, are they crazy ideas?
They're absolutely crazy ideas. And I'll tell you why I'm so excited about them and kind of in the broader context of the history of medicine. And I'll tie it into actually something my wife and I did a couple of weeks ago. We bought one of these, I don't know if you know what they are, these vacuum robots. They just kind of go around your room or your apartment.
You bet.
It looks like a giant black Frisbee, and I'm actually kind of stunned that they work. Mostly these things are toys, but this one really works. So if you think about the history of medicine, drugs are designed to target what are essentially those robots roaming around inside our body. Our body is full of these little robots. They're the proteins. They're the things that do the jobs of the cell inside the body, like insulin is a robot that moves sugar around. There's a robot that's responsible for pain, a robot responsible for immune response or inflammation. And for thousands of years, drugs, medicine, meant if you're not feeling well, if you have a pain, wound, injury, you take some kind of herb or some kind of plant, let's say the bark from a willow tree, and you rub it on that wound and you feel better. Or let's say the residue from an opium poppy, you don't feel good, you take that, you start feeling really good. So for thousands of years, for our species, that was medicine. Then a couple hundred years ago, 200 years ago, something changed, and that was chemistry. With the rise of chemistry, we got the tools, the technology to take the active ingredient out of those herbs and plants and put it in a vial, put them in a pill. So the bark of the willow tree gave us aspirin, the most widely used medicine on the planet. The opium poppy gave us morphine, or at much higher concentrated form, codeine or heroin, of course. How do they work? Well, you take those drugs, those molecules, those very small chemicals, they're like 20 or 30 atoms, and they're basically like throwing a little ball through the window of the house and hoping that that tiny little ball finds a crevice in the robot and stops it. So aspirin, which is taken from the bark of the willow tree, goes through the window, finds the robot that has to do with inflammation and stops it. Morphine goes through the window, finds a crevice in the robot that has to do with pain and stops it. Now, that worked great for about 100, 150 years. That was kind of the first wave of medicine until about 40 years ago, when we developed a totally new idea, which is, hey, let's build an entirely new robot and just put it in the front door if those robots aren't working. And so that's what became insulin, the first protein drug, the first genetically engineered drug. And that was an incredible breakthrough that won the Nobel Prize within like 24 months for the guy who came up with it in the 1920s, 1930s, Fred Bantick. you had these kids who were lying on their deathbed. You'd inject them with insulin. You'd bring in that protein robot that, you know, moves sugar around. And they would just get up out of their bed and kind of become normal little kids. It was an incredible breakthrough. Now, the reason I'm so excited, and actually many of us in the industry are so excited about mRNA, it's an entirely new approach. About 20 or 30 years ago, there was a group of scientists, or Dr. Caitlin Carrico is one of them, who's now at BioNTech in Germany, mm-hmm. one of the producers of the mRNA vaccine. And mm-hmm. she asked a really interesting, kind of odd question. Where do those robots inside your body come from? The ones that are running around like that vacuum cleaner robot just doing their tasks. Well, it turns out your body has basically these 3D printers inside it. They take some instructions and they make those robots inside your body. Hmm. And so those are called ribosomes, but you can think of them as just 3D printers. You feed in some instruction sheet and it spits out a fully formed robot. So she had the crazy idea, suppose instead of trying to make an entirely new robot outside, an entirely new vaccine and inject it, you know, bring it through the front door and so on, why don't we just slip a piece of paper to that 3D printer and have it just manufacture the drug inside the body itself? And that's exactly how the mRNA vaccines work. That's exactly what they do. That's why the Pfizer, Moderna drugs were so much faster than the traditional drugs, because they skipped manufacturing. It's just like a sheet of paper that you slide into a printer, and that printer, that 3D printer, just manufactures it. So you get to bypass what would ordinarily take years, but, you know, now is shortened to, you know, months of development work.
So you're talking about manufacturing literally less of a substance? Like, they just have to make a smaller amount of stuff because the only thing they're making is the instruction sheet, so to speak, and that is a simpler task than making a whole bunch of new robots?
Exactly. That's why it was ready in days, because you read, you know, on January 10th of this year, the genetic code for the virus was posted online. And within days, they just, you know, punched a button on the computer and they printed out the instruction sheet for manufacturing the vaccine, for the little 3D printers inside your cells, inside your bodies. They just printed it out. That's why it was so fast. That's why they were able to have a finished drug candidate, a finished mRNA vaccine in less than 4 weeks that they shipped, you know, then to the National Institute of Health to start clinical trials.
So are we done now forever with these four-year, decade-long vaccine approval things? I mean, the next pandemic that comes out of wherever it's going to come out of, because it will surely come, same deal? We figure out the sequence and then we just plug in the instruction sheet?
Well, I think we have to step back and say this is kind of an amazing breakthrough, yeah. And we're living through it every minute.
In real time.
We're
yeah.
really at that.
We're just ready to skip ahead, like, great, we never have to do this again. Awesome.
No, we're really in the first couple of innings. It's phenomenal that it worked and exceeded everybody's expectations. One of my friends, a former colleague, is, you know, runs R&D at one of the large pharmaceutical companies that's developing a traditional vaccine. I remember talking to him a few months ago, and he said, you know, he and his team, like many others, were fairly skeptical because this was a new approach that had never been tried. And like a lot of new approaches, people are skeptical about them at first. So this one really exceeded everybody's expectations. But there are a couple of caveats. First, it's still early days. We only have a couple months of data, and we want to get a lot more safety data that's long-term and efficacy data just to make sure that it's working well. But the second thing is, no drug, no matter how good, works in everybody. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as a magic bullet. People are very different. Their bodies are very different. So some drugs that work well in one group of people won't work well in another group. For example, you might have a drug that works well in younger patients but not older, or vice versa, and maybe none of them work well in immunocompromised patients. So what you really want is lots of tools in your tool belt. You want to have lots of different choices so that you can figure out what works best, in what combination, in what order, for what patients. And that's, very fortunately, that's where we are today, because there's 10 more vaccines coming after this one.
So these 10 more vaccines that are in development, it's not only about 10 more companies saying, oh, okay, we have a chance to make money on vaccines, right? Like, will they all be slightly different from each other, tailored for patients?
they're totally different. So there are kind of four broad categories of approaches, of kind of technologies for a vaccine, and you absolutely want to try all of them. Not only that, there's some even wackier, crazier ideas, things like a vaccine nasal spray or a vaccine that you can eat as a pill. And you absolutely want to try those, because imagine how much good you could do if you had a vaccine that was actually a pill. It sounds like a crazy idea, but there are people who are working on that. Or a vaccine that you could just spray in your nose. It would make it much easier. You'd be able to get to a much broader portion of the world much more effectively. And you want to try those technologies. If you look at the history of medicine, the first thing is almost never the best thing. In the case of these vaccines, the efficacy, the early efficacy is very good. And the caveats there is they're looking at the data very early, you know, just a few weeks after injection. And you really want to see how durable is the response. But either way, the one of the problems with these vaccines is they require very cold refrigeration, and that makes it very challenging to distribute. The ones that are coming later in January, February, or March will be much simpler.
Yeah, just real quick, I want to get to the economics of this for a second, but just real quick, why do they have to be so cold? We've all heard, oh my God, they got to be minus 47 zillion degrees. I haven't heard anybody explain why. Do they just have to? Is that just the deal?
Well, these mRNA, these like little instruction sheets that you feed the 3D printers, yeah, they're very flimsy. If you just put them inside a cell, they'll just fall apart in minutes or hours. So you have to protect them and you have to keep them cold. Otherwise, the heat will cause them to fall apart.
All right. Okay. So do me a favor and put on your entrepreneur and CEO hat, right? Because you've run a company, you've been out there trying to make a dollar in the pharmaceutical and biotechnology world. As you sat through the pandemic, as we all did, hoping against hope that Pfizer, Moderna, and BioNTech and all of them would get us to where we are today, and thankfully they have delivered, I would love your thoughts on what you suppose the people running those companies were thinking in terms of, man, I got to invest $2 billion, and I don't even know if this is going to work, and it's a potentially civilization-saving vaccine, but I got shareholders and I got to make a profit. Do that calculation for me.
You're right. And this is an incredibly important point that I hope the next administration understands. Vaccines are not a great business, which is why so many companies have left that business. Firstly, they're quite a small part of the pharmaceutical industry or drug discovery industry, maybe 5% or less, just in terms of revenues. Hmm. But actually, their margins are much less. They're very challenging, very difficult. So they're much less than many other drugs, which means their share of profits is like 1 or 2%. In addition to being a pretty tiny percent of the total kind of profit in the industry or return in the industry that investors might get from working on them, they have all sorts of safety issues and legal issues. You give them to children. There's the kind of anti-vaxxer sentiment. So there's just so much hassle. If you're a regular business person and you're thinking, should I work on this project and this business opportunity, which has got all these sort of legal quagmires and all these problems and it's very low profit potential? Or should I work something where the incentives are set up so the rewards are much more meaningful? So it's sort of an easy choice. Now, that's just people following the rules, the way the incentives are structured in our society. And if we want to change those rules, people can say, look, this is very important for society. We need to start from the top and change how we do this. And that's happened many times before. I ran a publicly traded company, and I think a lot of people who are business people have recognized that there may be no greater system for successfully driving innovation and new drugs than free capital markets. You didn't see a lot of great drugs coming out of the Soviet Union for the last, for 40 years, but you did see cures for cancer and so forth coming out of the United States, which had phenomenal capital markets. But what people miss is that markets will fail. Even Adam Smith wrote about this a couple hundred years ago. Markets will fail when something may be good for the society, but a bad investment for any one company. So even genetic engineering 40 years ago, no company could have afforded to invest in it. Why? Nobody had any idea if it would work. So it was the federal government that invested in it because it was good for the economy, good for business as a whole, that we were doing that basic research. GPS, it's been incredibly good for so many businesses. No one company could have built a fleet of satellites around the United States, around the planet, but the federal government recognized it could be good. Much of the early personal computer industry, these industries were started when the risks were so high and there were collective problems, not individual problems. And that's the same with vaccines. I hope the next administration will recognize that a biological threat is as serious and as important as a nuclear threat, as I think we're all seeing this year. And therefore, we need to invest in the research that can support a much broader, much stronger, much more robust program around biological threats, around viruses and bacteria and pathogens. How do we prevent them? How do we treat them?
Safi Bakal is a biotech investor, author of the book Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. Safi, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks. Good stuff.
Cool. Yeah. Outstanding.
There you go.
Yeah, one of the things that we talked about, he and I, for the tech show this week, because we're doing a crossover episode, you guys.
Yeah.
And also previously was the idea that because this technology exists, there's almost a way to sort of like line up, like figure out almost in advance how to tailor vaccines for lots of different types of viruses.
Oh, yeah.
And so you could really have, you could think of it as like bullets in the gun, right? Like you just, so you have a lineup like ready to go so that when a virus appears, all you have to do, I mean, not all you have to do. I know this is the jumping ahead part because in some ways when you hear him describe the 3D printer, like I'm just saying those of us who watch I Am Legend are like, it feels like things could go wrong. But that you could, with sufficient investment, have a lot of pre-developed vaccine technology in your arsenal.
Yeah.
Ready to deploy.
Yeah.
Once you sequence the genetics.
I frankly am glad to have gotten out of that with an understanding of why they have to be so cold. That's all I'm saying. I have not heard one story in the last 3 weeks about why it has to be minus a zillion.
I know, right? It's just like
cold chain. It's got to be cold chain. And I'm like, yes, but why? And now we know.
Right.
Now we know.
Yeah.
So there we go.
There you go.
Yeah, that's right. So first of all, let's do the crossover again. Safi Bakal is coming on Marketplace Tech later this week at some point, right, for a convo.
Tomorrow, I think.
Tomorrow.
But yeah,
there you go. And there you go. If you've got questions, comments, additional information, which we always like on this podcast, let us know. It's makemesmart@marketplace.org. Quick break, as we always do on a Tuesday right about now, and then coming back.
We are back. You don't know, but that break was quick, even quicker than it was for you. It was a quick break. We are back. And we're back with the news fix.
Yes.
I love it. Kai has chosen a URL, at least, that is near and dear to my heart.
No, well, it goes, the thing that got me thinking about this story, and it's a piece in the New York Times today saying that Uber is basically giving up on its self-driving car venture. I just recall all those times where we talked about self-driving cars, either on Marketplace or on this podcast, and you were like, this is so hard. It's unbelievably hard. People don't understand how hard it is, and there's like five people in the world who understand it, and that's why there's the talent war, and blah, blah, blah. And I thought of that as I read this piece, which was that Uber, which, you know, arguably has the most to gain out of anybody by self-driving cars, is going, I'm out. Don't have it anymore. We're going to give over our whole thing to a startup in Silicon Valley. You guys figure it out. We'll invest, but I'm not doing it anymore. And you have to believe Dara Khosrowshahi, the CEO of Uber, was like, it's just too hard, man, and I got other things to worry about, you know?
And what's so crazy is that this is, you know, like Uber, it like did the insider trading situation. Mm-hmm. They hired that Lewandowski guy who stole the trade secrets from Google, who's now on the hook for the however huge the settlement is. They bought the company. I mean, just like went through extreme convoluted law-breaking lengths to launch this autonomous car. division, and now it's just like, meh. Yeah. I will say that in addition to it being incredibly difficult, like definitely when I saw this, I had the same response. I was like, uh-huh. Yeah. Self-driving cars are not as close as you think. Take 1 million.
Right, right, right.
I also thought to myself, and someone tweeted something very similar, which was like, well, the other thing, though, is that this was like a long-term hedge on a business that didn't rely on all those expensive drivers.
Yes, right. And so now that $200 million they spent on whatever the prop was out here is money well spent, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Like if Prop 22 out here turns out to become the law of the land, which is that they don't have to hire drivers as full-time employees, then all of a sudden that particular cost center looks a lot more promising in the long term. So if you put it in the coldest of business terms, it's like, why mess with this fuzzy thing when it turns out now we have an infinite supply of cheap drivers?
Yep.
Wah, wah. I made it dark.
Yes, you did.
That's but both of those things are probably true. Both of those things are probably true.
Yeah.
But yes, I know. We all want self-driving cars, but this is going to be a long time.
It's going to be a while.
I could not choose. This may surprise you. I could not choose. One is but a quick update on something that we talked about yesterday, which was Palantir and all its government contracts. Palantir, of course, the Peter Thiel run company, Peter Thiel from the PayPal mafia and a big early co-founder or early mentor of Mark Zuckerberg. He's a big Facebook guy from back in the day, too. Palantir has among its dozens of contracts that it has secured with U.S. federal agencies in recent years since Peter Thiel became probably the most high profile Trump supporter in Silicon Valley, has won an FDA contract now to power drug reviews and inspections.
Man.
A 3-year deal worth $44 million. I'm just going to keep bringing these up because they are just happening under the radar nonstop. Like Palantir just keeps closing deals. And it was my understanding there was like a bidding process and that since taxpayers pay for this stuff, there was supposed to be some transparency in how these... Yeah. Bits are made. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, you know, I don't know. But I'm just saying, keeps on happening. We know that buddies always get deals. Like, I'm not new here. I know that's how government works. But this buddy is getting a lot of deals.
Do you suppose, this is just a random historical question, do you suppose there's an analogous time in history where a company got as much access to as much information, not, you know, on the sly, but without public awareness? I just, because it's really a lot. And I think if people understood, and look, this isn't a new phenomenon, right? It's been going back ever since the information age started, but it is kind of wild.
I would say probably IBM historically is probably the closest corollary, where IBM and the U.S. government, my understanding is, really were inextricable for years. Yeah. And I think there's probably... you know, aerospace deals that are similar. But what is really substantially noteworthy about Palantir in particular is that its whole deal is big data.
Yeah.
The whole deal with Palantir, the whole name from Lord of the Rings is like the creepy all-seeing eye used by the villains. And so
that's really long on a business card and wouldn't get too many people.
Yeah, exactly. So Palantir is like way cooler sounding. But that every one of these deals gives it access to data at an at a level that, you know, is hard to even contemplate.
Yeah.
That would be a really interesting piece, though, the history of, like, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
The kind of, like, how companies and governments do become intertwined. I mean, there's, you know, no question, like, Lockheed is one of those companies in the space race.
Right,
like this. Well, this feels different.
Right. The differentiator this time is, you know, so Lockheed and the government can be working together, and they can come up with the X-15, and that's great, and we can fly 4 times the speed of sound, just in memory of Chuck Yeager, right? Although I didn't think he ever flew the X-15. But anyway, right? But that's not personal data of really intensely... not only personal, but useful stuff on a macro scale, right? That's the differentiator.
Like drug approvals.
Right.
And,
right.
I mean, you know,
right.
Medical data. Like, it's a big, this is, and again, we don't know. Maybe there's incredible, because hope springs eternal. Maybe there are incredible protections in place to make sure that Palantir can't just like run away with the data.
Sorry.
Exactly.
Sorry, did I do that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the only appropriate response to that.
Yes.
All right. I literally deleted my next one because
I saw that one. I saw that. I'm like, oh, that one went away. All right.
Turns out that was the one.
Turns out. Okay, mailbag, go.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
Hello. It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
I'm on board with that.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got a bunch of voice memos. You guys are delivering. Thank you. Jennifer from Maryland sent us this voice memo after last week's deep dive on the 401ks and retirement.
As Kai probably knows, the military has one of the last defined benefit retirement plans, but only if you serve 20 years. In 2018, the military began offering a blended retirement system, which made the military retirement more like what the 401k was supposed to be, an augmentation of savings for those that serve the full 20, and something transferable for those that leave the military service earlier. This gives those that only served 4 or 6 years more savings towards future retirement than they previously had. I thought it was really interesting that this was seen as the military modernizing their retirement system, while the data indicates that 401ks aren't the best retirement savings vehicle. Perhaps the 401k isn't the best right now, but they seem to give flexibility to workers when the norm is that people don't stay in the same job for decades in order to earn their defined benefit pensions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the military looked at what was out there and said, okay, we're going to go with the 401k system-ish because that's what we've got and we don't have the oomph to develop a whole new thing. But it's a really good point about military pensions and how they are now saying, in light of more people probably, I'm making this up, I don't really know, but my guess would be fewer people are serving the full 20 or 30. People who leave after 4 or 6 or like I did after 8 and you don't really have any pension savings. So I think that's a good move. From the Pentagon, I think.
Yeah. She also raises a good point that one of the benefits of the 401k is that even though it's tied to employment in some ways, it's still a portable benefit, which is like a bigger conversation that we're trying to figure out, right, as the future of work changes. Like, do benefits have to be tied to a specific employer? Yeah. Could there be health insurance that is not, I don't know, that is portable?
Yeah. Voice memo number 2 on the podcast today, you guys are awesome, is from Rebecca in Baltimore. Complicated feelings she has about going back to the classroom. Here you go.
We've been virtual this semester at my university, and our plan is to bring students back in the spring. So I cannot even tell you how excited I am at the prospect of seeing my students in person again. I cannot wait to be back in the classroom teaching again after teaching on Zoom all semester, which is utterly exhausting. Yeah. At the same time, am I a little nervous about the risks that I am taking on? Yes, I am. One thing that surprised us as a university that we just learned fairly recently is that although we keep saying that we did not bring our students back to campus, we realized that they came back anyway. They just didn't come back into the dorms. We have hundreds of students who return to the city where our university is and are renting apartments. They're living with roommates and friends. So this is a lot of complicated factors that we're all thinking about. And as much as I have mixed feelings about it, I really would like to see my students in person again next semester.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. We just had that conversation in my household. My son's dad and I about just like, do you think they're going to come back in January? Do we want them to? We do. But we're terrified, and then the teachers, and I mean, it is just such a, it's so hard, but it's hard to imagine that parents can also hold out between January and summer and not go back until next fall. All right, one last voice memo from Maymay. She sent this in after our chat last Friday about vaccine hesitancy and a tweet from a science writer who said the focus should really be on vaccine equity and logistics.
I'm a bit disappointed and a bit hurt, I'll just say, by the way you all are discussing the vaccine issue. Yes, there is a definite case to be made for focusing on logistics and equity versus hesitancy. But you should not downplay people's real fears as a person of color, I'm speaking. Our real fears about taking this vaccine. I have been mentally and psychologically terrified in this country in a way that I never thought I could or would be. But that certainly factors into how comfortable I'd feel taking that vaccine. I have seen how people of color and Black people specifically, our pain is not treated the same. We are dying in childbirth at higher rates. So yes, there are the historical factors to take into consideration, but there are also the present and the current day factors that let me believe that I can't have the same level of trust. It's not the same level of choice for you as it is for me. Thank you. I appreciate you listening.
Yeah, for sure. And I appreciate you writing in and calling us on it, for sure. 100%.
Yeah, thank
100%.
You. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is the burden of systemic racism in this country and the distrust that that's created in every system mm-hmm. in this country is a hill that does have to be climbed. You're absolutely yep. right.
For sure. Thanks for writing.
So thank you.
Yep.
And now we will leave you with an answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about?
In my day job, I'm a statistician, and one thing I thought I knew but recently found out I was wildly wrong about was my misplaced confidence in the ability of all of us to make meaningful sense of the sheer size of COVID fatalities. As we hit 300,000 deaths, I think we all need some kind of shared unit of measure to help us get our head around this number. So give this a go. A typical 737 seats about 150 passengers and crew. The 300,000 COVID deaths translates into 2,000 fully loaded 737s crashing with no survivors. This translates into 7 crashes a day, or 1 crash every 3.5 hours. Could you even imagine the nationwide response to 7 domestic airline crashes per day, yet we can't even convince our fellow citizens to wear a cotton mask at the grocery store?
Yeah, look, yes to all of that, you know. Yeah.
Yep. That was Patrick in North Carolina, by the way. It's when I was coming up in journalism, the plane crash is the example of the event that stops everything.
Right.
Like right. You'd leave for the night, you know, and you'd be like, don't call me unless a plane crashes.
Yep.
Or, you know, we don't authorize overtime unless there's a plane crash. Right. Like that's the thing. That is the biggest thing that can possibly happen. And it's happening 7 times a day.
Every 3 hours. Your answer to the Make Me Smart question will hopefully be just a tad less depressing than that, but that's okay if it is too, you know. email your voicemail.
Get it together,
or
people.
Just email us, take your pick, makingmesmart@marketplace.org. The question again is, what is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about?
Yep. And now it is that time of year again. And ironically, our plea for your support involves a cloth mask, among other things.
It does. And those of you who were with us on the YouTube live stream on Friday saw the masks. They're great. Also, they have a large nose thing so that those of you with large noses, they won't hurt you and press you down. Anyway, marketplace.org/givesmart. And here's the bottom line, though. If you can, do, and if you can't, we get it, because these are difficult times for everybody. It means a lot to us and to the rest of the Marketplace team when you guys support us. It just does.
It does. Thank you for supporting independent public journalism. We're here for you, and the reason that we can be here for you is you. It's like, it's a circular economy, everyone.
Go ahead. No, yep. You go ahead. Mm-hmm. No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to give the deets on the mask.
Okay.
Before, right. Which are at any amount right now, actually, if you donate at marketplace.org/givesmart, only this month you can get our new face mask as a bonus gift. And I've been wearing it around. It's super nice. It's 2 layers, but it has a pocket for a filter, adjustable ear loops. I could tell you as a mask maker, I bought a whole bunch of those little rubbery doohickeys to adjust the ear loops, and it makes the entire difference. That's the whole ball game, because then it can fit anyone. It's so great. And it's only available, like I said, through the end of the month.
I had forgotten, actually, that you were making masks in the beginning of this thing. You're still doing that or no? You got your mask?
Yeah.
Oh, are you really? Wow.
I have some seasonal fabrics. I mean, I took a little break for moving, but I'm excited to get back to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're a fan of mugs, coffee mugs that have really ugly logos on them, we have one of those too. And that can be yours for just $5 a month. We appreciate you supporting us, even if you have terrible taste in logos. That's fine, too. But look, it holds your coffee, and that's all that counts. That's what I'm saying. That's all that counts.
It turns out this is the hill that Kai Rosedale is going to die on.
I'm going to die on this hill. This is the hill. Logo.
That is it for us. Tomorrow, may I suggest a question for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday on how Marketplace derived its
I would like to know logo. Because nobody checked with me.
There's
nobody
still time to, send your questions.
Oh, my goodness.
Make me smart at marketplace.org.
Garrett, save us from ourselves. Save me from myself. Everybody else is doing fine. I'm the one in trouble.
We found the hill.
This is how you know nobody in St. Paul listens, right? Because we haven't heard Butkus on this one.
This is the hill. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ethan Perez is our intern. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skill. I don't know why they keep letting me say Ethan Peretz.
Whatever. I do what's written in front of me. Today's show is engineered by Garrett Lang. Emma Erdbrink is going to do the mix later on. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Donna Tam is filling in for our senior producer, Bridget Bodner, who's out on family leave. As you know, baby number two is enjoying lots of tummy time, she says. Plus, the whole family appreciates how Make Me Smart keeps them connected to the real world because, quote, it's all kind of a blur right now. Bridget says. I also, did we get an update on the name of this kid? Do we have that?
A baby update.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.